is Bird Note. Former Washington Governor Jay Inslee made the fight against climate change a major priority during his three terms in office. He passed laws that cap greenhouse emissions, promote clean energy, and align state policies with global climate goals. Inslee says his love of birds is one of the motivations for his efforts.
Birdsong to me is just such a rich part of my daily life. It just perks me up. There are many threats to our birds where we're, you know, maybe one out of eight species are in real trouble worldwide. Obviously, habitat loss is significant, but climate change is the ultimate destroyer of worlds, including in bird life.
Inslee believes everyone has a reason to want to protect the environment.
You may want to have snow in the mountains to ski on. You may want to have air to breathe in August so that forest fire doesn't smoke your kids. So there's many reasons, but one of the principal ones for me is to keep birds in my life. You know, when I hear the red-winged blackbirds, you know, they're whistling, and I think they're whistling to say, get off your duff and go fight against climate change, partner. So they keep me inspired.
Learn more about the difference you can make for birds at birdnote.org. I'm Jonice Franklin.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, Burnaby. We are rooted in community support and engagement. Thank you for helping us stay on air.
Hello and welcome to the Canadian Philosophy Show. I'm your host, Brandon, and today I'm joined by Hale. You and I have been talking a little bit about starting our episodes with a small sort of introductory segment to the show, not necessarily related to the topic that we're going to be going into, but just some things to kind of get us up to speed on the philosophy we've been doing. So this episode, we're going to be discussing two ostensibly unrelated papers, one of the research papers by Eric Schwitzgebel, and a short kind of exploration of a passage by Pierre Hadot. But we'll start the episode off by looking over a quote, a philosophical quote or passage that we both are kind of bringing to the table, and then maybe an idea or a question that we've been exploring prior to the show, just in our own time.
Yeah, as we bring it, as we go into this segment, I think for our listeners, we were going to maybe call it like a quote and a quandary for as our little opening segment for our shows. So we've got a little bit of stuff today. I know we both brought some quotes, and you've got a little quandary to bring up as well.
Yeah, so I'll start with my quote. It's quite short, actually. The text it's from is from, like, many of the books that I get and I read, I grab from a free book pile at the university, frankly. And there was a book called An Incomplete Education, which is basically just a big compendium of filling in the gaps for, an incomplete education. And it has a philosophy section. And I thought that the tone of the book is usually quite humorous and is not entirely serious, but it's still very informative. And I was curious to see what its philosophy section would consist of. And the philosophy section is, again, very brief, very cursory, obviously reductive. But the very first sentence of the philosophy section I found very interesting and actually kind of compelling. It is, philosophy is the study of everything that counts. And I suppose counts here means anything that matters, anything which we have a stake in, anything we value, anything that we really feel we need to discuss. Philosophy is the place to discuss that, to think through it, and to take even the most trivial things or the most abstract and give them their light of day, take them seriously for a moment to really try and think them through. So I thought that was despite the book being, again, quite unserious and humorous, I found it was surprisingly insightful and saw through to kind of what philosophers at least think is valuable about philosophy, that when we are doing philosophy, something really matters.
Fortunately, I did not pick such a short empathy quote, but I'll read it. It's more for our listeners. It's more like a short passage. It won't take that long, but it's from Lucretius, his work on the nature of things. And just very briefly, Lucretius was I can't remember, was he Greek or Roman? But he was a Greco, he was Roman, that's what I thought. He was a Roman philosopher that was around at the end of the Roman Republic in the first century BC. And he basically, he's in the Epicurean school, which we won't need to go into, but he also wrote this text on the nature of things, which gave a remarkably accurate description of like some base structures around around reality from a scientific perspective, although he was obviously doing this primarily purely through observation. This was before the scientific method, all that kind of stuff. And he's one of his most famous things. He's known for the atomist theory, right? That the world is create, that every object and things, you know, is made up of tiny little atoms and they're all connected somehow. And in between them is void, is space, is nothing else kind of stuff. It's interesting because it's just a very it is remarkably close to the truth, it turns out, and this was someone who lived 2,000 years ago. But he wrote, this is from his work on the nature of things, and I thought it was a great little passage on, you know, the process of sort of human beings coming to, you know, a position of curiosity and a position of knowledge and a position of truth-seeking, which is obviously, you know, all just fundamental aspects of philosophy. So I thought I'd read out this little passage here. So, and remember, this is a 2,000-year-old quote, so it's the language is a little different. When human life lay groveling in all men's sight, crushed to the earth under the dead weight of superstition, whose grim features lured menacingly upon mortals from the four quarters of the sky, a man of Greece was first to raise mortal eyes in defiance, first to stand erect and brave the challenge. Fables of the gods did not crush him, nor the lightning flash and the growling menace of the sky. Rather, they quickened his manhood, so that he, first of all men, longed to smash the constraining locks of nature's door. The vital vigor of his mind prevailed. He ventured far out beyond the flaming ramparts of the world and voyaged in mind throughout infinity. Returning victorious, he proclaimed to us that what can be and what cannot be, how a limit is fixed to the power of everything and an immovable frontier post. Therefore, superstition in its turn lies crushed beneath his feet, and we by his triumph are lifted level with the skies. So again, I thought I really liked that quote's imagery and kind of like, obviously he picks a guy from Greece because he's familiar with the Greco world. But, you know, this idea that like we lived in an era of superstition, an era of kind of untruth, of dogmatism, but that, you know, when man started to, or humanity started to really get curious and not take for granted the things they're necessarily told, but instead try to learn and understand and think critically, basically, that opened up a whole new world and a whole new way of being and a fundamental understanding of how the world functions, or at least getting to these, you know, what we might call laws of nature and stuff like that, right? So I thought it was a really cool quote. I also sometimes I like reading very old quotes. It's kind of fun.
yeah, it's interesting. I mean, Lucretius's work, it was a poem, so it makes sense that it's written that way. It's also interesting, like, as an Epicurean, I think he's gesturing towards Epicurus, though, when he says that this person goes through over to another world. It could also be referencing Parmenides, but it's interesting where he talks about, It's also interesting, too, how it kind of anticipates Francis Bacon when he talks about conquering nature, that we will have to sort of, if we want to be victorious against nature, we have to devise different means, and it will be through knowing in that way.
You know, this is odd. When I read this quote, admittedly, what I sort of thought was, you know, there was an intellectual world in places like the Roman Empire and stuff that was obviously very fruitful and active. And a lot of that was obviously lost during the fall of Rome. And sometimes I think about these things and think, you know, like, would, in terms of advancement, whatever we want to call that, right? Like, would we be, like, how much farther would we be ahead had, you know, there been a different transition from the Roman period, right? Like, what, from that kind of the class, like, you know, the people talk about this all the time, from the classic period to what we now call, like, the Dark Ages, which, like, I'm more than familiar enough is not necessarily, like, an accurate way of putting it. It's obviously a lot more, like, opaque than just, like, yeah. Oh, yeah, everything got really bad and people got really stupid for, like,
well, you know the reason years. It's called the Dark Ages, right?
Actually, I don't.
So the reason it's called the Dark Ages is it is a term used by historians, but they use it non-pejoratively. They use it just to mean that there are very few written records at the time. And the reason there are so few written records is because at the time, like this could be a, I have like a small interest in like the material history of ideas as well. But basically, as the Roman Empire falls, the roads crumble. The transport of papyrus, which has to be rewritten because it falls apart so quickly. There's no more papyrus to renew the documents, right? So only places that grow papyrus, so the Middle East and Egypt, are able to continue sort of sustaining their documents and their corpora, their literary world. Whereas in Europe, they are either written on parchment, which costs about a house to make a book out of, or it is just stashed away in monasteries, and monasteries at the time are becoming Christian, so they're very selective about what they're preserving, right? So there's a kind of what the historian Ada Palmer calls an unconscious self-censorship that goes on. Things that don't really interest the emerging Christian world just kind of fade away, because papyrus can't, it's a material problem. Papyrus can't be transported throughout the Roman Empire because there's no Roman Empire.
Yeah, and it's, I like how you kind of brought that up too. It's kind of a structural censoring almost, right? Like it's, now I'm sure, you know what, frankly, I know because there are people like Tertullian and stuff like that, other early Christian, you know, fathers of the Christian church who were very aggressively against anything that basically wasn't directly under the auspices of the Christian religion, and were very active in like destroy. Also, a lot of stuff was like destroyed, right? Like, it's like intentionally. But I think the vast majority probably just wasted away or was thrown out, or you know, people couldn't read it anymore or whatever. And just like you're saying, it's kind of an interesting example of sort of this kind of like structural censorship, where it might not necessarily be always intentional, but you know, if places like monasteries and churches are the vectors of knowledge collection, well, then the only knowledge you're going to be collecting is stuff that they're interested in.
We're trying to relate, again, two ostensibly unrelated papers, but I think that once we start exploring them, we will see that they are sort of gesturing towards the same, or not necessarily gesturing towards the same theme, but one paper kind of sheds light or illuminates something that I do want to highlight about the other. And I want to start with the more, I guess this is the more contemporary one, yeah, because this is published in June 2012, the Eric Schwitzgebel paper, Ethicists' Courtesy at Philosophy Conferences. So Eric Schwitzgebel is, I should have gotten something about his biography, but in any case, because I'm not sure, I think he's American, I think he is a professor at an Australian university, but also an American university. In any case, he has a series of papers, in fact, a number of studies doing empirical research, kind of checking ethicists and philosophers who study ethics for ethical behavior. The one paper that we're reading today is checking ethicists' courtesy at philosophy conferences, but he's done other papers. One of the other notable ones is he was checking to see how often books on ethics were returned, whether they were late or whether they even went missing. And you can sort of do this to check, well, are ethicists stealing the books? Doesn't that seem a bit hypocritical? And drawing the conclusion from there as to whether studying ethics, being an expert in ethics, reflecting on moral problems, whether that actually makes you a more ethical person. Now, the verdict from all of these studies is that they don't necessarily make you a better person, but they don't also seem to make you a worse person. So essentially, ethical reflection doesn't seem to make any real difference in whether you are an ethical or an unethical person, as most philosophers seem to claim that ethical reflection should make you a better person. Schwitzgebel's studies seem to run counter to that intuition, which in a certain way, when you think about or when you hear this, this sounds kind of shocking, right? Like you would think that, so, I don't know, a marine biologist should be better at taking care of fish or something, right? Or like a nutritionist should eat more healthy. Like it would make a lot of sense that these people would benefit from their knowledge, whereas it seems that ethicists don't actually seem to act any more ethically than anyone else, which seems, essentially, it doesn't reflect well on the profession itself. And these papers are discussed around the ethical circles because of this implication, right? So considering that this is, it is ostensibly a philosophy paper having a philosophical conclusion and making an argument, but it's actually quite empirical. So what they did was they went to, I'll read, this is from section 2.1, the method. We observed courteous and discourteous behavior at 4 meetings of the American Philosophical Association, the 2008 meetings of the Pacific, Central, and Eastern Divisions, and the 2009 meeting of the Pacific Division. At the Central and Eastern Divisions, we noted what proportion of the audience left behind cups and trash. At the Pacific meetings, we also noted rates of mid-session talking versus remaining quiet and door slamming versus shutting the door quietly. So they are observing 3 behaviors that they are considering courteous, and they're also equating being courteous with being ethical, right? And if we look at the data for how this stacks up, so they checked the ethics sessions at this conference, at these conferences, against non-ethics sessions. We should find that at the ethics sessions, if moral reflection makes you a more courteous person, there'll be less instances of these kinds of discourteous act or behavior. That does not seem to be the case. So the rate of audience talking during formal presentations at the ethics sessions, there are 15 instances of talking, whereas at the non-ethics sessions, there are 12 instances of talking. So this averages out to about instances per hour, is there's 10 or 0.01 for the ethics sessions and 0.009 for the non-ethics sessions. So for door slamming, we do a similar comparison. At the ethics sessions, there's 52 slams, and at the non-ethics sessions, there's 77, but they check this against how many entrances and exits there are, and essentially the conclusion they come up with is that the median percentage of slams per session is 18.2 for the ethics sessions and 15.4 for the non-ethics session. So there's more door slamming going on. at the ethics sessions because of the number of exits and entrances and exits and the number of sessions and the percentage of slams at those particular conferences. So, and again, for the trash left behind, there's cups and there's other trash, but the numbers are pretty similar for the check against the ethics and non-ethics sessions. So cups left behind for the ethics sessions is 197. There's 284 for the non-ethics, but if you check that against the cups per audience member, it is actually more for the non-ethics sessions. There's on average more trash left behind and more cups left behind at the ethics sessions. The only exception that they find is for environmental ethics. So in any case, there does seem to be less trash left behind at the environmental ethics sessions, which makes a lot of sense. But at the same time, the overall showing or the overall results are that ethicists do not necessarily engage in less discourteous behavior than non-ethicists. Now, I've been kind of going over these numbers because that is the meat and potatoes of the paper. And the conclusions that they draw are essentially this, that, there doesn't seem to be, like, we would think that if people became more moral by being engaged in this study, they would not do this, but they do. So what's going on? And it's just kind of a big question mark left at the end of it. But if you're kind of listening and your eyes are rolling in the back of your head listening to this, this is not there. This is kind of why I'm bringing up this paper, is because there seems to be something a bit, I don't want to say off. I don't think that Schwitzgebel is like pulling a fast one on any of us, but there's something that I'm suspicious about with this kind of evaluation about the efficacy of ethical reflection on character, right? And it's essentially a question of, well, I don't know if, well, first of all, I don't know if you can even, so my first question is empirical data like this any kind of indication of what we would consider like the results of ethical, you know, any kind of ethical cultivation? Ethical reflection is not necessarily the only way to go about it, right?
The paper was interesting. I also get your apprehension. Now, I think I want to the authors, to Schwitzgebel and company, I want to give some, I want to be like somewhat charitable. They do seem pretty self-aware of many of the like criticisms that will be leveled at them. And obviously they're really like that, like their empirical study was quite small and really was quite like narrowly focused. So really we're just getting some very general ideas here. But I think that one of the biggest ones that comes up immediately for me, and it is mentioned in the papers where credit's due, is that these acts of like courtesy that they're measuring don't necessarily reflect like primary ethical issues, right? Like that some of this, especially like the letting your door slam or your, like a lot of this is sort of like social habituation, it's cultural, and therefore it's not necessarily like, it's not, you're not looking at samples of people, you know, going through a real life trolley problem and being like, all right, you pull the lever, do you kill five, do you kill one? It's very much like this person that didn't stop talking and was being kind of rude. What we would think of in today's age, society, culture, listen, stuff as rude, as would a lot of other peoples in different places and times. But it might not be the best measurement of like really important ethical matters and how people kind of measure up to that. However, I do want to say as well that I went into the paper expecting philosophers, expecting ethicists to really not score any better and perhaps score worse on ethical issues. And I personally don't think that there's a very deep connection between, which I think we're going to get into more as well, as kind of discussing this, between, you know, being a academic philosopher and having that translate over into actual ethical behavior or whatever it's going to be, right? Like, people's, you know, how people present themselves and what their interests are oftentimes is revealing of them, but not completely. And it's so much so that people can have interests that are, actually, I'll use myself as an example, actually, because we talked about this many times on the show. Like, I it's well known for our listeners that I'm a big history nerd. I like all sorts of different stuff like that. But I have a particular interest long term in, you know, the story of, you know, the kind of rise and fall of the Third Reich and those sorts of fascist movements and all that kind of stuff. I'm glad to say that politically I'm pretty much the opposite of those individuals and those sorts of movements and all that kind of stuff. But I still find that stuff very interesting. So I really don't think that there's some sort of necessary connection. But I also think, and this is also brought up very briefly in the paper as well, that there's some criticism that actually this is probably not true, but that philosophers are actually worse people, because basically what it allows, the kind of critical thinking, the argumentation, and the sort of all the theoretical stuff, gives one just better equipment to sort of, you know, justify their own actions and beliefs and all that kind of stuff, good or bad, right? So it's like it's convenient, you know. You're doing some self-sophistry in a way.
Yeah, you kind of know the rules of the game, so you know what you can get away with. So that seems to be one picture of ethicists and how they might actually be worse than just the layman. Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, I think it's interesting the nature of the subject of this study. You bring that up, and I think that is important, and especially as we're going to go into the Hadot paper. But that's the other thing that I sort of always wondered about this was, so I'll read the very first sentence of this. So philosophers have often claimed that thinking philosophically about moral issues tends to improve, or at least can improve, one's moral behavior. And this is cited, or this is backed up by a slew of citations. So Aristotle, Plato, Kant, Mill, Adams, Moody Adams, and Nussbaum, and even developmental psychologists like Paget and Kohlberg and Turiel. I've always kind of been skeptical of that claim in itself. And I also want to point out something about the Aristotle citation as well, that, and I'll get to the Aristotle in a second, but this idea that because you study moral theory, or because you understand it or how it's like structurally or conceptually articulated, just because you study that necessarily means that you are a better person, or you're a more moral person, or that you're going to study philosophy in order to become a better person or something like that. I don't know of any ethicist that actually, it's interesting, right? Because there was another paper that cites the Schwitzgebel by Brian Van Norden. He was discussing one of the four books where philosophers actually, like, empirically, or not empirically, because obviously, but one of the things that is value about philosophy, and that we claim it is value about philosophy, when we're kind of poked in the chest to say, well, what's philosophy? So, like, what's so great about philosophy? We really do claim that something about a person seems to improve, or that philosophy can improve a person, right? We become better people by engaging critically. We become more responsible. We become more sound. We become more considerate or empathetic, or something like that. So I think sort of anecdotally, or just like as a vibe, I guess, we really do think that philosophy improves a person in some way, but I don't actually know of any philosophers who claim or who argue that in this specific way studying philosophy or reflecting on ethics will also make you a more moral person.